Right, so, okay, great. So I'm Rick Hansen. This is April 1st, 2015. And this Dharma talk really is not a joke, I hope. And I want to talk about the most famous serial killer in the history of Buddhism, Angulimala. And you'll understand what I'm going to talk about in a minute. So first I'd like to offer two brief quotations that will put this in context and also link it to kind of a personal situation. And then I'm going to go through this ancient sutta, and see what you think about it. So the two brief teachings are, this is from the collection of the Buddha's earliest teachings. He says here, "One is not low because of birth, nor does birth make one holy." This is in the context of the India 2,500 years ago, where there was a tremendous emphasis on just you were stuck based on your birth, and that's all you could do about it. He said, "Deeds alone make one low. Deeds alone make one holy," including acts of thought and speech, as well as body. So it's a focus here on personal effort and the opportunity, which was socially and politically radical of his time, that anyone could go forth into homelessness, as they put it, take up robes, and participate as a full, equal member of the Sangha, the gathering of monks and eventually nuns on the path, even if prior to that, the person was the lowliest of the low or the highest of the high. Deeds alone make one low. Deeds alone make one holy. So it draws us into our own deeds and those deeds that make us low and those deeds that make us holy. And then he says in a separate passage, "As a certain kind of mental deed, above, across, or back again, wherever one goes in the world, let one carefully scrutinize the rise and fall of compounded things." In other words, the rise and fall of experiences and the rise and fall of material phenomena as well, but certainly the rise and fall of experience. And the context here is that, as in all of his teachings, for what it's worth, see for yourself, the Buddha is basically, his intention is to say to people, this is what you need to know to get enlightened. That's his framing. You want to get awakened? You want to get enlightened? You want to be radically free from suffering forever? This is what you need to know. This is what you need to do. It's in that context. He also says this is a teaching that's good in the beginning, as well as the middle and in the end. It's okay for beginners. It's okay for just starting. But it's richly useful in the middle of practice, at the intermediate stage, and also in the advanced stage as well. But it's designed as an offering. Again, we see for ourselves what is true for us. It's designed as an offering toward full awakening. You know, those deeds, those actions, including that observation of impermanence. What causes things to come into being? What causes them to pass away? So it's in that context, then, that I want to talk about, on the one hand, the hopefulness here. Deeds alone make us holy, and we can start those sorts of deeds at any moment. On the other hand, even though we may well have made personal transitions, there are still consequences rippling forward in time that we may still be stuck with. And those consequences don't mean that our practice is not real. It just simply means we need to take them into account. So it's in that context, then, that I want to talk about Angulimala. Okay. So this is the Majjhima Nikaya. It's a collection of teachings. As you probably know, there was almost no writing at all in the time of the Buddha. There was a lot of emphasis on oral memory. And fairly credibly, teachings would be passed down for many generations in a row. Different monasteries would be responsible for memorizing different passages. Periodically, there would be gatherings to sort out what was legit and what was not. I've asked scholars what fraction of the what's called polycanon that we have today, what fraction credibly are considered to be most likely, as best we know, the teachings of the Buddha himself, and the consensus is probably around at least 80%. That's pretty high. So it's in that context then that I'm going to offer this here, and I'm going to leave out certain sections that are repetitive or little detail about certain locations of the time and see what you think. Remember, this is written in as scripture in a sense. It's not exactly what people would say in the vernacular of things, but it's pretty close, and there's a little bit of repetition to help people remember it. So here we go, okay? So on this particular occasion, there was a bandit in the realm of Kosala named Angulimala, who was murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Villages, towns, and districts were laid waste by him. He was constantly murdering people, and he wore their fingers as a garland around his neck. A mala is a necklace, Angulimala, the fingers around his neck. Then, when it was morning, the Buddha dressed and, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into the local town for alms. When he had wandered for alms and had returned from his alms round, after his meal he set his resting place in order, and taking his bowl and outer robe, set out on the road leading toward Angulimala. Cowherds, shepherds, plowmen, and travelers saw the Buddha walking along the road leading toward Angulimala and told him, "Do not take this road, recluse." A monk, a recluse. "Do not take this road. On this road is the bandit Angulimala, who is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Villages, towns, and districts have been laid waste by him. He is constantly murdering people, and he wears their fingers as a garland. Men have come along this road in groups of 10, 20, 30, and even 40, but still they have fallen into Angulimala's hands." When this was said, the Buddha went on in silence. For the second time, for a third time, people told him the same thing. The bandit, Angulimala, saw the Buddha coming in the distance. When he saw him, Angulimala thought, "It is wonderful. It is marvelous. Men have come along this road in groups of 10, 20, 30, and so forth, and they have still fallen into my hands. But now this recluse comes alone, unaccompanied, as if driven by fate. Why shouldn't I take his life?" Angulimala then took up his sword and shield, buckled on his bow and quiver, and followed close behind the Buddha. Then the Buddha performed such a feat of supernormal power that the bandit Angulimala, though walking as fast as he could not catch up with the Buddha, who was walking at his normal pace. Then the bandit Angulimala thought, "It is wonderful, it is marvelous. Formerly I could catch up even with a swift elephant and seize it. I could catch up even with a swift horse and seize it. I could catch up even with a swift chariot and seize it. I could catch up even with a swift deer and seize it. But now, though I am walking as fast as I can, I cannot catch up with this recluse who is walking at his normal pace." He stopped and called out to the Buddha, "Stop, recluse, stop, recluse." The Buddha replied, "I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too." Then the bandit Angulimala thought, "These recluses speak truth, assert truth. But though this recluse is still walking, he says, 'I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too.' Suppose I question this recluse." Then the bandit Angulimala addressed the Buddha in stanzas, poetry, thus, "While you are walking, recluse, you tell me you have stopped. But now, when I have stopped, you say, 'I have not stopped.' I ask you now, O recluse, about the meaning. How is it that you have stopped and I have not?" The Buddha replied, "Angulimala, I have stopped forever. I abstain from violence toward living beings. But you have no restraint toward things that live. That is why I have stopped and you have not. That's such a really, this is Rick talking, not the Buddha. That's such a really central point. Like last week we talked about the mind racing, constantly seizing what it wants, racing, racing, racing. So we're having here a certain kind of internal stopping. So Angulimala replies, "Oh, at long last, this recluse, a venerated sage, has come to this great forest for my sake. Having heard your teaching, I will indeed renounce evil forever." So then, to move through a certain amount of material, Angulimala becomes a monk. He takes up robes, you know, becomes a renunciate, renounces violence, adopts the precepts, and so forth. And a little bit of time passes. Various soldiers come to get Angulimala. The Buddha says, he has changed, he has transformed. Really, you can trust me, I can tell you for real, his heart has changed. He has stopped in his heart. He's become a monastic under my protection and teaching. Okay. But then, time goes on, and Angulimala, wandering through a town for alms, for food, inviting Donna, much as we do here, sees a woman in labor. She's trying to have a baby. And Angulimala talks about it as that she's in difficult labor and painful labor. And he goes back to the Buddha and says, what could I tell her that would put her at ease, would help her? And then the Buddha says, Angulimala, you should go tell this woman, sister, since I was born, I do not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By this truth, may you be well, and may your infant be well too. So that's what the Buddha tells Angulimala. But as we know, Angulimala has killed many, many people. So Angulimala asks him, Venerable Sir, wouldn't I be telling a deliberate lie? For I have intentionally deprived many living beings of life. And then the Buddha replies, Then Angulimala, go into the town and say to that woman, Sister, since I was born with the noble birth, since my heart was changed and I stopped in my heart, since I was born with the noble birth, I do not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By this truth, may you be well, and may your infant be well too. So to make a key point here, we go through transformations, even small ones. We have a moment of clarity, a moment of seeing, the heart opens, in meditation, something shifts inside us. And as of that moment, on that basis, there is a kind of birth. You can think of the parallels here, you know, that kind of preview, baptism in Christianity 500 years later, other symbols and other rituals and other traditions, this idea of being born again in a sense. And one of the illusions that's continually produced by the brain is the illusion of continuity. Even though over the course of a minute, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of cells die and are reborn. Probably most of the atoms in the body are replaced every 7 years or so, roughly. You know, the mind stream is continually changing. It's continually unstable. But to create the, you know, some sense of continuity that helps us survive, the brain's constantly creating this illusion of continuity. But in many ways, each moment is a new birth, you know, is a new opportunity. And that's really, really hopeful. I think oftentimes we presume more than we need to that we're trapped in the nets of the past. On the one hand. But on the other hand, after Angulimala goes through an awakening, then when it was morning, after his awakening, the venerable Angulimala dressed and, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into a town nearby for alms. And on that occasion, someone threw a dirt clod and hit the venerable Angulimala's body. Someone else threw a stick and hit his body. And someone else threw a potsherd, whatever that is, and hit his body. Then with blood running from his cut head, with his bowl broken, and with his outer robe torn, the venerable Angulimala went to the Buddha. The Buddha saw him coming in the distance and told him, "Bear it, Brahman." Brahman, noble person. So Angulimala, bandit, has become a noble person. "Bear it, noble person. Bear it. You are experiencing here and now the result of deeds in your past. And if you had not gone through your own transformation," I'm paraphrasing slightly here, "you would have been stuck in a variety of hells for a long, long, long time. This blood streaming down your face is the least of the consequences for the deeds in the past, even though you are now born into a new life. Your heart has stopped. Your heart has changed." Right? So you see the reality that even sometimes, for example, in our relationships with people, we've given up the quarrel and they're still at it. You know, I've often been kind of sort of amused by the fact that it's typically when we get off our position that other people somehow, there's a kind of space that opens up for them to really nail us for it. You ever notice that? Like, you're not doing it anymore. You've stopped in your heart. You've stopped. But they still have a kind of momentum. And what must we do? Bear it, noble person. Bear it. It doesn't mean be a doormat. Doesn't mean be a lightning rod or a whipping boy or girl, what have you. But there is something about living with the reality of what still is rippling through our lives, even though we ourselves have changed dramatically. Sometimes there might be the impulse to prove to the other person that we've changed. "Come on, can't I get any credit here? You know, I've transformed, right? I'm not doing that thing anymore." But you still are not done reading me the riot act for my impacts on you. My heart may have stopped. I've changed in my heart, but there still are ripples spreading out from the stones I threw into the pond of reality in days past. And I need to bear it. I need to be with it, but not let it make me doubt my own transformation, including the transformation of my intentions. You know, I'm still needing to consolidate whatever that realization is, whatever that wholesome intention is, that resolution. I still need to consolidate it. I need to wake down, not just wake up. You know, I need to not fall into the mistake of the spiritual bypass, so-called, that John Wellwood has written about, where we have a realization, but that's all it is. It's not embedded in us. Gurdjieff, the mystic and teacher, described psychedelics as like a telescope. They show us what's possible, but then we need to walk there on our own. In many ways, realization is like that. We pop into a new state. We have a new sense of things. But to really stabilize it, we need to take in the good of it. We need to internalize it, you know, really embed the stabilized sense of that into our own body, especially in our nervous system. So that becomes more and more the new normal. And then I'll leave you with a final quote here and see what you think about this. I find this Angulimala story something I keep coming back to, including that image of, you know, them walking along. Angulimala is trying to get the Buddha, can't get him. And the Buddha says, "I have stopped. Why don't you?" You know, like, So to finish here, the quote is from Angulimala. This is him speaking, supposedly. He says, conduit makers guide the water. Remember, this is a very rural agricultural environment. It's farming. Okay? Conduit makers guide the water. Fletchers straighten out the arrow shaft. Carpenters straighten out the timber. But wise people seek to tame themselves, stopping in their hearts. What do you think about our friend the serial killer here and the teachings, including stopping in your own heart, recognizing that we are being born newly every day and there's lots of opportunity there, and still, even when we're on the other side of that, you know, change, especially in our relationships, we may still need to bear it. Bear it. Okay. What do you think?
It's not easy.
It's not easy. Yeah, that's true. I was seeing someone earlier today, and I'll leave the details a little disguised. This is someone with tremendous capacity to go into deep meditative states, who was also terribly traumatized as a little boy in a variety of sustained and very creepy ways. And even though he has real capacities to go into great sense of bliss and impermanence and oneness and okayness, he's constantly, his body is continually agitated with fear. It's a meaningless fear, but it's agitated with fear, especially around other people, because that's where the trauma came when he was young, right? So there's still a rippling through his body. In this case, he wasn't Angulimala, you know. It's just he's innocent, utterly innocent, unlike Angulimala, but still he has to bear it. And the important thing is to not make it mean more than what it really is. Okay. What do you think about this? Deeds alone make us holy, right? The wise seek to tame themselves, stopping in the heart. Yeah.
I was just going to say, this part of not being a proponent of yourself and your transformation is a real walk. And what I've found in my own situation where this is kind of thing has come up, if I start to talk about it, I lose it. I mean, yeah. I lose part of it. And so I just have to have faith and integrity with myself to, you know, stand firm and keep going and be a demonstration, not a talker.
Right. Thank you for saying that. You know, there's a true story. It's used as a story, which is a woman who came from a very fundamentalist Christian Southern background did a long Buddhist retreat in New England at a center, and she was quite worried about what would happen when she went home. Okay, and she went home, and roughly a month went by, and she wrote a letter back to the teachers at the center in New England, and the key line, which she has allowed to be published, is speaking of her family. She said, they hate it when I'm Buddhist, but they love it when I'm a Buddha. And, right? And again, not taking sides in any way, just understandably, you know, it's like our kids, right? They don't like being lectured, but they love it when we walk the talk, right? Just what you're saying. Yeah, please.
And then secondly, how do you spell Angulimala?
Yeah, check it out. It's really a powerful story, and it's probably historically accurate, at least to some significant extent. I believe it's Angulimala.
Okay.
Yeah, just like it sounds, kind of phonetic. Great, please.
I found with that, with things where I feel that I've changed a little bit, that I really want immediate gratification for that. And sometimes if I can just hang in there, sometimes 2 or 3 weeks later, maybe I'll notice the person with whom I've interchanged. I've noticed that, oh, they got it, and I didn't get it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thank you. I've often felt that our self-concept usually lags around 6 months behind, you know, what's really true, for better or worse, right? And, you know, yeah, I think sometimes we don't realize that there has been a real change, you know, but our mind is kind of in the rearview mirror. Anyway, yeah, great.
I was thinking of all the Guli Malika people who are in prison today, you know, who could be redeemed.
Yeah.
You know, if we could go into the prisons and help them, you know, that was my thought.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And, you know, what you make me think about, again, in the story of Angulimala, there's so many aspects to it that are quite remarkable. Like, why would the Buddha bother? And if you just think of him in his place, he's trying to start some new deal, right? Why, you know, why stick up for a bandit, right? Why go out of your way? And in the story, at least, the Buddha sought him out. Like, what was that about? And I just think about how often we really feel deep in our hearts. I was seeing somebody else earlier today, a different person actually, who, in a funny way, in his own heart, he feels like the things he's done make him and the things that have been done to him have damaged him irreparably. He's irreparably stained. And how often it is that we think that redemption's impossible, that we cannot have that noble birth, as it were, that noble birth is for other people, right? But in fact, no being is irreparably stained, right? If they're willing to do the deeds that make one holy. And that's the key point there, you know. And yet we still may need to live with the consequences, including in jail, perhaps. So it's
and execution.
If that's what happens, yeah. I'm not in favor of that, but anyway. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I guess I'm drawn in some ways to the victims.
To the victims, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess in parallel fashion, perhaps they needn't be irrevocably marked by these events, but that's of a different order in my mind.
Yeah.
And it leads me to think, and I don't know what the Buddhist ethic is around this matter, but I certainly think about the whole question of reparation and recompense in this regard, and what role does that play?
Yeah.
And does Angulimala just sort of get to go off into the monastery and develop himself?
Yeah.
And, you know, fine, great, you want to be kind to him, but what about, you know, the other piece of this?
Yeah. These are huge questions, and I think, like, you know, parables in general, there's not a right answer. You know, I have, like, offer a take, and it's okay, other people offer a take too. Bringing it back to ourselves, it just makes me think about situations where, with dignity, we recognize that we are going to keep paying a price for things we've done, even though the doer of those things is no longer present in our own heart, right? And one example that I've seen routinely that I've just had such admiration for is people who have gone through sobriety. You know, they were alcoholic or drug abusers, and they did maybe in some cases really, really bad things to other people. And I've had people like that in my office who are absolutely rested in their own sobriety, and they're completely at peace with that, and they know they've really changed in their heart. And simultaneously, there's no defendedness in them for the consequences still coming forward in their relationships, in doors that are permanently closed to them. They can't vote because they were felons, whatever, you know. And to be in that state of peace, you know, which also gives us the freedom to change in our heart, right? We may not be able to change the external ripples. We threw those stones in the pond. You know, we did that thing with our kid, you know. Certain things happened in that child's relationship with us that are still in the space 30, 40 years later. And maybe they just won't repair around that, and we have to live with that too, perhaps. So we live with that, but at the same time, we can always preserve for ourselves and retain for ourselves the freedom inside our own heart to do the deeds that make us holy, to stop inside our own heart. And I find that incredibly beautiful in terms of opportunity and the freedom there, which sits alongside not one molecule of minimizing what happened in the past, the harms we did, the difficulties we caused, the impacts, and also in our heart, we can have gone through a kind of noble birth. Tarne.
I heard this really interesting backstory on Ongali Mula. I don't know if it's true, but I heard it somewhere. And it was that he was a student, he was a monk, and he was studying.
Yeah.
And he was very dedicated to his guru, and his guru was a little twisted and didn't have the best intentions and for his student, and was even jealous of his student's brilliance. And he told him to go collect a mala of 108 fingers. And that would prove his dedication to his guru.
Mm. Yeah. Well, thanks for saying that. I've heard that in the commentaries, and
we
don't quite know. But yeah, but again, it rounds it out, doesn't it? It rounds out the story.
Yeah, a little bit of backstory to the person, not just a serial killer.
Yeah,
but
that's
a person.
Right. Yeah, that's very good. Okay, thank you. Great, yeah.
Well, the thing you said about the man that was so traumatized when he was a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, he has all that, and it wasn't anything that he, particularly did, but he was given that.
Yeah.
And I guess we all are given things that
that's
we
right.
didn't ask for, that men didn't necessarily deserve or want, but they're given to us, and it shapes the way we behave and act, and, it's part of the deal.
Yeah, and think about it for oneself, what was handed to us, and how can we also do the deeds that make us holy, including observing causes, the rise and fall of compounded things. Yeah. Yeah.
somebody asked about why the Buddha would seek this person out who seems so kind of lowly and irredeemable. I was just thinking that maybe the Buddha kind of realizes that we're sort of co-creating our karma, as a culture. And people get into roles and act out certain kinds of things. It's like in a family where, there's one kid that's IP that's, gets scapegoated and does all this stuff. Or,
the identified patient, so-called. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe in some way that him sort of bringing that to light and healing that, it healed something for the whole culture in terms of that.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, that's right. One way to think of it for ourselves is that we do things in this moment that throw stones into the pond that ripple into the next moment. So in this moment, we're riding the waves of the stones that we threw in the pond the previous moment, right? And the opportunity is to ride those waves while still knowing that we can be, born nobly into this next moment in our own heart, no matter what waves we're riding, right? No matter what we need to bear. That's amazing. Okay, a couple more people, then we'll wrap up. How about first you, then you, and then we'll finish.
I don't have this very clear in my mind, but this has been a very powerful night, and I love that so many men have spoken up. It's really nice to hear from the men. What I sense is that we all get born, and we're completely innocent and beautiful, and then all of a sudden, life starts doing these kinds of things to us. And it seems as if we have to experience some pain to finally get to a place, if we do, that we learn that is so powerful to hurt someone else that we don't want to do it.
Yeah.
That we learn that we're really here to create a better life. for all of us, and we couldn't know it unless we've made some of those mistakes. I don't know.
Oh, beautiful. I'm glad my microphone was so close to you. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Good. Thank you. And then last person?
It's funny because for everything that everybody said tonight, I kept thinking of the word eponymous. Yeah. But I actually had a comment, just like the gentleman up front, about your charge, your person that you were talking about.
Yeah.
It seems so painful to me, that kind of suffering.
Yeah.
And I wondered how you address the fact that, how you address that his thoughts that come up that make him suffer, how he can let go of that and find more peace.
Yeah.
That's my one question. And then also I felt like for Angulimala, a lot of times when the Buddha came up and said to him, I stopped, now you stop, is it greed, anger, and delusion that he stopped, or is it some other thing on the wheel of dependent origination that has, that he's talking, referring to when he says, I have stopped?
Yeah. It's a great question. So in reverse order, the first one about what does the stopping mean? I mean, for me, that's in many ways one of the most memorable turning points. I come back to it again and again myself, you know, in my own practice. Have I stopped or am I continuing to fabricate and construct suffering, right? And we can stop the fabrication of craving, the construction of craving, the construction of clinging, the construction of greed or hatred or delusion. We can stop that. The body keeps on going. The mind keeps on going. And the ripples from those stones a minute ago or a year ago, perhaps a lifetime ago, can keep rippling through, right? But the internal process of I-making and my-making, or of clinging or essentializing or problemizing, as I was talking about during the meditation, that's just fallen away. And that's what he's really talking about. That's what's so remarkable. The body, the Buddha says, the body is still walking, but I have stopped in my heart. You know, whereas your body could be perfectly still, but your heart is not stopped. Your mind is still racing, as I talked last week, seizing whatever it wants, right? And which goes to your point about equanimity, where there's kind of an internal balance, even though life itself hasn't stopped and keeps moving, right? And then the client, it's a very deep matter. What do you do when the body's in absolute red alert, even the world is green? You know, his life today is very, very safe, very secure, very established, and yet, you know, the body's just absolutely twitching. And I think it goes to lots of other things as well, where we're still dealing with just what's rippling through us. And, you know, I want just to be kind of quick about it, a couple of things. one is to really recognize the reality of false alarms. We're constantly surrounded by alarms that are false, and we're constantly surrounded, honestly, by bamboozling promises of joy or pleasure that also are false. And we're constantly, so it's kind of like recognizing that a lot of what twirls through the mind is like just a nightmare, but it's not really true. You know, there's really no boogie person or being, boogeyman, under the bed, you know? And so that right there is really powerful. And I talked with him about being, because he's strong. To survive what happened to him, he had to be strong. And I'd say to each one of you, fight your way to the sanctuary where you can take refuge in your knowing in this moment of what's really true. And then fight your way again. Think how many stories, how many myths are about the hero, male, female, what have you, fighting their way through the thicket, you know, including the thicket of shadows to the place of sanctuary. The sanctuary is in here, in the heart, right? To fight our way to what we know is true, and then hold on to it, and then do it again and again and again, and gradually carve out a beachhead there. So you increasingly stabilize that sanctuary, and then grow out from there. And that's a profoundly important practice, and very hopeful, because it's on us to make that fight. And sometimes we can't even make the fight. We just ride it out. But when the when we move back out of the 0 to 10 scale, we climb back down out of a 10 of distress or pain or suffering and quote-unquote merely innate, you can make that fight. You know, you can't make the fight when you're just totally overwhelmed. Then all you do is ride it out. But when it dials back a little bit, you can always make that fight. That's that. And then the other thing, if, you know, more and more, if you can do this in your practice, and that's kind of what you work toward, is you start recognizing the nature of experience distinct from experiences themselves. And you increasingly are not managing your relationship to particular experiences, particular sounds, particular feelings. You know, there's a place for working on your relationship to fear, okay? But you get to a place more and more where you start recognizing that fear, or the sense of me in relationship to fear, all that is just one more aspect of mind altogether, the mind process. And you start recognizing that the mind process altogether, you know, what is its nature? And you realize, wow, taken as a whole, it itself has no problem. There's no problem that I'm terrified, in a sense, at a certain level. The mind as a whole has terror in it. At that level, it's just mind as a whole. And more you kind of go out to that. You see its impermanence. You see its compoundedness. You recognize that experience, its nature, is insubstantial, and it doesn't need to be so compelling. Make sense? Kind of, you get that? And that has to be real for a person. We have insight into that, and then we lose it, then we have deeper insight, we stabilize it more and more. And increasingly, that's where your kind of practice goes. Less and less about content, and it becomes more and more about process, or just the altogether nature of experiencing. And that's an opportunity for us, too. All right. Remember, deeds alone make one low. Deeds alone make one holy. How about we sit for a minute? Thank you.